English, you need to adapt to the terminology. So, yeah. But that you will adapt very, very quickly, and you get into to that. Yes. Okay. So then, having this kind of color vision background foundation, we can dig into color science. And as indicated this morning, so the lecture today is also kind of very basic stuff. Before we will have a 2 hours lecture next week, in specific related to the CIE color science, color spaces, X, Y, Z, three stimulus values, integration of color matching function, time slide source, something we discussed earlier, which is also a kind of a need to have in your backpack for the cross-media color reproduction course with Phil Green. Because to some extent, he kind of, he expects that you have a kind of a certain level of this type of topic. So therefore, probably it's good to have these 2 hour session on these kind of fundamentals, which then helps you for Phil's course as well, based on my previous experience. Okay. Yes, some terms. Colorimetry. Colorimetry is a kind of a branch of color science concerned with numerical specifications or specifying the color of physically defined stimuli, such that two stimuli that have the same number have also identical specifications. So colorimetry is divided into color and meter, also measuring color, whereas radiometry is the measurement of radiation, or spectrophotometry, measuring of the intensity of visible light. If we stick to the term colorimetry, the main goal of colorimetry is actually to model the human perception of color. And to reach that goal, we can divide the task into a kind of three main statements. So the first is that each unique color has a unique colorimetric coordinate. That means that two colors having the same numerical values have the same appearance, obviously. And two colors with different coordinates, different values, obviously have a different visual appearance. So that is a kind of the first important definition. Then the statement number two, colorimetric values should be represented in a coordinate system, which dimension are perceptibly orthogonal and represents some correlates of the principal perceptible attributes of color. So what are the principal main attributes of color? Are you able to recall? I assume you guys.
So you might say there's hue, saturation, and lightness.
Yeah. typically. So these are kind of the three main dimension, and that is part of this, what is called the three-dimensional color space, representing now in that sample as a C-lab color space. To the design students, I have a lot of design students in the spring semester, so they are perhaps not as technically, advanced. These are they think more in the design dimension. So I used to say that in a three-dimensional color space, we can think of, let's say, a football or a basketball, or these type of body or shape, where we have this three dimension, as you said, the lightness dimension, with the black on the bottom of the basketball, and on top we have the white. And then we have two opponent axes, as we learned this morning from Hering, the two opponent color pair, typically green, red on the one side, and then on the other side, the blue and the yellow. And that is the kind of what is called three-dimensional color space. And then, of course, a desire is also to have a kind of a perceptible uniform color space, meaning that the distances in such a space are perceptibly equal. Or in other words, if you look at this Munsell tree, I also will get back in the lecture more details about this Munsell tree. But it has a similar structure as the C-lab. So basically, we can talk about a lightness axis, or in Munsell, he's talking about value, where we have the black is on the bottom and the white is on top. And in that case, we do have 10 different hue colors, so light blue, kind of two different greens, yellow, orange, red, and we do have a chroma axis with a departure from an achromatic color in the middle, also from a gray color towards a hue color. And if I talk about that, the color space should be perceptible, equally spaced. That means that the visual difference between a certain patch going up in the lightness or down in the lightness or towards the gray axis or towards the U should be equally the same. Of course, under certain illumination. Now we can discuss, is that the proper illumination for that task, or should I go outside to get daylight? But let's put that aside. So that is a desire to have a three-dimensional color space with the three dimension, and at the same time having a perceptible equal distances. It sounds perhaps very simple, but still nowadays, after so many decades, as you know, there is still a desire to get a better perceptible color space than the C-lab. We'll get back to that. Okay, so now that was the second kind of the desire and orthogonal color space. And then the third point is related to color difference. So the magnitude of difference between the numerical values representing two colors should be proportional to the perceived difference between them, which actually bounces back to the three-dimensional color space, where the desire is to have such a system with equal perceptible spacing. So then schematically, if you have two stimuli which are identical, obviously the numerical value is zero, there is no difference. And if we have slight differences, then the numerical value is increasing. So this is a kind of the foundation for the colorimetry, and then as in every kind of topic, there are always some exceptions or limitations in terms of how big can a color difference or a number be in a certain space. So now I just distinguish, okay, this is perhaps approximately a color difference of 10. So would it make sense to have color differences of 50 or 100? No, that's one of the limitations in that C-Lab color space. Then we need to apply other color spaces. Or talk about HDR, then C-Lab is probably not the appropriate color space to cope with HDR colors. So there are a number of extension or new developed dedicated color spaces than C-Lab. Going a little bit back in history, so colorimetry has something to do with describing color. So if you look through the literature, you will find a very large number of color systems. Some are dated back several hundred of years. Many are theoretically related. Some are based on a specific set of samples. And some are based on physical measurements and calculations. So our desire to be able to arrange colors is very old, and already over 2,500 years ago, the Chinese have dealt with it. So this is nothing new. But then in Europe, at around 1700, it is known two Swedish chaps, Forsius and Brenner, published the very first color circle and color map. But then only after Newton's time, the subject became a topic for serious research. So that is just a kind of to give you a picture of color ordering system and describing color. So let's continue with methods of describing color. And again, it is possible to structure that in different ways. So in this lecture notes, I used these three main types of describing color. So there are systems based on color mixing, there are systems based on color perception, and the last one dedicated to the CIE system, color matching. So now in the following slides, we will address each of these three types of color mixing. Describing color, and we start with color mixing. So considering the methods based on color mixing, the system exemplifies the relationship between certain color primaries and their intermixture. So in printing, typically we do have four certain primaries. What is the name of these four certain primary colors? CMYK, yes. On the other hand, what kind of primary colors do we have for displays or projectors? Yes. So the primary colors are a particular set of colorants used in a coloration system. And related to these primary colors and the intermixture of these of all these colors, we can also talk about a color gamut. So a color gamut is basically the range of color which we can produce by a coloration system, and very important, under certain viewing conditions. So talking about the gamut of this Munsell tree on this illumination. Or under this illumination, then the gamut probably has exceeded. What about the contrast over here? Or let's get some color. It has reduced. So therefore, remember, very important. if we talk about a color gamut has always a certain size, depending on the viewing conditions. So we always kind of claim that, let's say, printing newspaper or printing on recycling paper, the color gamut is much less compared to a high dynamic range display. But this is not always true. So now if we take these type of setting where we have a lot of light, then probably HDR is very limited, and suddenly the cheap newspaper color gamut is much bigger. But of course, if I switch on the light, then it is vice versa. Then the newspaper color gamut is very small, and then suddenly the contrast is much bigger. So therefore, this is kind of important to have in mind. Yeah, I mentioned already typically device color representations for RGB are displays, projectors, scanners, cameras. And this is also what is called additive color mixing. Any idea why we talk about additive color mixing? Yeah? Right, absolutely right. So starting starting in the cinema, no light at all, and then in that case we are talking about the three primaries, red, green and blue. So we add energy or we add wavelengths, and we are ending up with kind of a neutral white if the three primaries are added in relationship to each other. On the other hand, if we talk about subtractive color mixing, yeah, you want to take the lead on that?
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah, because CMY, like in their spectrum radiance, they're just, you know, we subtract them from each other when we add them together. For example, we have red and then we have like yellow, we subtract them, and so it's going to be down. When we mix them all, we are going to get black because we subtract them all. And,
Right. So it's basically the opposite process. So starting with light, and then in that case, or what you said with printing ink or printing primaries, they act as a kind of a filter. So if we add cyan onto a paper, then the cyan color is acting as a filter, transmitting. Which colors?
It's absorbing.
Or absorbing? What?
If we have it a should look be absorbing at red and like emitting blue and yellow, blue and green, the way that we see it there.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Right. So if we add an area of cyan onto a substrate, and we use white light, then the complementary color, so now we can talk about the complementary color here. So we have red. The opposite or a contrast color is cyan to red. The opposite color from green is magenta, and yellow is blue. So at the same time, in the additive color mixing, we start off with red, green, and blue. And the overlap of, in that instance, additive color mixing of red and blue, we end up with magenta. That's exactly the way we mix color on the display or on the projector. Or if you want to obtain cyan, then we mix primary blue and primary green to obtain cyan. And to obtain yellow, we add red and green.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When we look at the color cycle that artists usually use,
yeah,
they oppose blue with orange and purple with yellow. Why is that?
Probably there also we need to distinguish colors which has a kind of translucent properties and colors which have a kind of a opaque property, I suppose.
So when you're talking about...
So with typically watercolor or this type of printing colors, if you mix them together, you obtain a kind of a secondary color. But then you might have other type of colors with different properties. When you mix them together, you are just ending up with a darker color or black color. So I'm not sure whether that is the proper answer. Then you have artists. They may just use a different type of ordering system.
Yes, because that was like confusing to me because we see here
opposed
another way, but it's
that's right. So it also depends, whether we talk about subjective color mixing or we talk about
I'm not sure that they're talking about the subjective. Yeah, because they're working with paint.
You're right. So if you talk about light sources later on, then we will see. So white light basically is produced with the primaries red, green, and blue. But now we see that most of the LED lighting, they use only two LEDs. As far as I have seen and measured them, then I measure a lot of energy in the blue and I measure a lot of energy in the yellow. And then the question is, okay, but now we just had the additive primary colors are red, green, and blue. And now you're saying with a LED, you can obtain white light with blue and yellow. And the answer is yes, of course, because yellow is a mixture of these two colors, and that is just to reduce basically the costs. I'm not sure whether I was able to answer your question about the artists. I doubt, but let me think.
The thing is that they are never convinced, and I am never convinced at all.
Yes, so coming back to the subtractive color mixing once again. So if we add the cyan color on the substrate, then the cyan ink or pigments, they act as a filter, absorbing the contrast color or the complementary color red, whereas then blue and green transmits. It is entering the eye, hits the cones, and the color sensation then is light blue or cyan. And if we add if we continue with adding magenta onto the blue, then magenta is basically absorbing
the green.
So now red has already been absorbed by cyan, and now we are absorbing green. What is remaining basically is blue, and the sensation is blue, and so on. So that is the idea with the complementary or with the subtractive color mixing. I think I've mentioned most of that. So that we can also very easily demonstrate either on a laptop using any kind of image processing tool. But if the time permits, I can just easily set up these very old-fashioned overhead projectors and using some physical filters to play with additive color mixing, and also playing with subtractive color mixing. But then another question is, okay, so we just said additive color mixing, we start with no energy, and then we add energy, or we add photons, we add certain wavelength, and we might end up with neutral light. On the other hand, we said, okay, subtractive color mixing, we start with white light, we start with a substrate, then we add these ink filters onto the substrate, cyan, magenta, yellow, and we end up with no light, meaning it is black. So then my key question is, why do we then still need to add black? Why does all these printers across the campus have a black cartridge and not only cyan, magenta, yellow? Any idea?
Save money, probably, because if we want to produce black, we have to combine all of those beams together, and it's going to cost a lot, probably. We're using our color inks, but when we add black, so for those parts that we need black, we only use black ink, not the combination of all those three inks.
And there's one other thing, and that's that like the primaries are not perfect, so it would end up into a brown.
That's actually the kind of the technical how do you say? Technical explanation. Of course, you're also right. So it is known that colored ink, as a cyan, magenta, yellow, is much, much more expensive than black pigments. So that there is obviously a very high economic reason for that. Now you could also have another claim. So if you would print a very tiny typeface, you know, like 4 points or 3 points typeface, then you need to have a very high quality printer so that the registration of cyan, magenta, yellow really, really fits. And that is very often not the case. So then you have a kind of a blurring, because you are using three different inks versus one ink. But the main reason is just the imperfection of on that system. So I show you this booklet. So basically this is a very old kind of color booklet with all the printing inks printed on this double-coated paper. So what you see on the first page, this is a color combination of cyan and magenta. So there is no yellow underneath. So as you can see, the bottom row here, we start, this is solid cyan, and then we have different fillings or different percentage. So
So there we have only 5% cyanine, and the 95% is basically paper white. And then if we increase, we have 50% cyanine on the horizontal axis. So then if we add also magenta, so magenta is on the vertical axis, that is 100 magenta on top and 5% on the bottom. Now the remaining is a combination of cyan and magenta. So then if we take, for instance, 50% cyan and 50% magenta, then we end up probably something like that. So that is the color, mixed, printing inks 50% magenta, 50% cyan. And now, if we turn the page, on that page, in addition to cyan magenta, we have 5% yellow added. Then we can go on like that, that's 10% added, 20, and so on, 50%, and at the very end. So under all these patches, there is 100% yellow added. Now, as you said, if you check, the overprint of 100% cyan, 100% magenta, and 100% yellow, we would expect black. But the best what we get is kind of a multi brown. And that is just through to the imperfection of the inks. I mean, we talked about the theory adding cyan, and cyan will absorb all red, or the third part of the long wave area. That would be only true if the inks would be perfect. But the case is, it is perhaps only 75% of the red which is absorbed, and then still 25% of the red is transmitting. And at the same time, the idea would be that green and the short wavelength area should be transmitted, but also due to this imperfection, some of these two areas also gets absorbed. And that results then in this imperfection of having a muddy brown and not the black, basically. That is also the case with all these printing systems. Okay, yes. Good. Okay, let's continue with color perception. So, as seen, the color mixing system results from defining a set of primaries and a coloration process. So, a perceptible color system results from defining a set of visual perception. And this system begins actually in our mind. So as in color mixing system, in which the primaries are evenly sampled, like in that system as well, the perceptions are sampled even more evenly based on these attributes. And most of these color systems are based on perceptible attributes or principles. So such systems are typically embodied with atlases of color samples rather than mathematically systems with a relationship to colorimetric coordinates. And coming back to the three main attributes, these are hue, saturation, and lightness.
So it is very common to describe a color visually using these three properties. So hue, basically, the color tones are distributed on a color circle, as seen here. So we have the hues on the periphery of the color circle. Then we have the lightness, as shown here, with black on the bottom and white on the top. And from the departure of a neutral grain towards the hue, this is defined as the saturation. Then there are some other type of system which has been found, especially in the back in the 60s, 70s, related to computer graphics. This is basically known as HSL, also hue, saturation, lightness, or hue, saturation, and value. So these are the kind of alternative representations of the RGB color space. Now again, coming back to a designer, assuming you have three RGB digits, 128 red, 50 green, and 250 blue. What kind of color is that? So you have to be trained really tough to know the numbers and the corresponding color. And if you want to make a change, if a customer says, no, I want to have a different hue, or I want to have a different or a less saturation, or increase the lightness, then it becomes very difficult to cope with these three RGB numbers, unless you are really trained into that. So it's much easier to cope, actually, like in a image processing tool or like Photoshop, where you can use brightness, saturation, and hue. So basically, you can just increase the brightness, the hue, and the saturation remains, or you can play with the other two dimensions. So it's much more intuitive to use these three dimensions than using RGB. So I remember when I did a apprenticeship back in the 70s. So at the end of these 4 years, in one of the exams, they showed me an object. I don't remember whether it was a coffee cup, a brownish coffee cup. And then they said, okay, tell us the cyan, magenta, yellow, and black code or percentage on coated paper. So then you had to learn about that system. So you knew that, okay, a brownish color or a skin color, you have always the most yellow, then you add a little bit magenta, and at the end you could define either adding cyan or a little bit of black. But that was a kind of craft work. So you had to kind of use that for quite some time. I mean, there was no display at that time, so that was really handcraft. So I remember that was tough. I mean, today everything is a kind of VC-Vic, as Steve Jobs defined his Mac. So what you see is what you get. So okay, HSB color model. And then, as I mentioned, a typical perceptible determined color system is the Munsell color system, which was developed by Albert Ory Munsell, also back in 1905. As a learning tool for his art students. So by the way, Munsell, he was an American painter and teacher of art, and also the inventor of this well-known tool. So his goal was actually to build a color ordering system that is based on both a numerical and physical color patch obtained via what is called Atlas of the Menzel colors. So this is a kind of just a pedagogical type of tool. But in the lab, we have several Menzel books with these different hue pages. And these patches, they have been used for several experiments. So we talked already about saturation. In a couple of slides, I will show you how CIE defined different attributes. So then we do not talk only about saturation and chroma. There is also colorfulness. So a kind of very complex. And in addition to that, some other scientists, they proposed, okay, let's replace some of these attributes with an attribute called vividness. So there is a bunch of terms kind of related to the appearance of color. And to conduct such an experiment on the screen, for instance, then we used these physical patches. We measured the patches, we obtained the colorimetric values, and then we transformed that these colorimetric values onto an sRGB or any other calibrated monitor. And then we asked the observers, for instance, to rate certain color shades according to high vividness or low vividness or high chroma or less chroma. So that these are typical applications of using these physical patches. Yeah, his desire for numerical classification led him then to these 10 different hues, as I mentioned, these 10 plates of and 10 steps of values from 0 to 10. So the values, so he called this not for for lightness, that is in the Menzel language, the value. And that is kind of a sample from a very old Menzel Atlas book. And again, what is most important with this perceptible color system, once again, it has exactly the same perceptible differences, meaning that that's calibration, color calibration, color management. That's also something you're going to learn about. It looks different here than here. And even though we have so many color scientists in the lab, but nobody is able actually to implement color management in these lecture rooms, It's embarrassing, but you know, there is a huge distinction between theory and practical implementation. Yeah, but coming back to my point, if you talk about perceptible uniform distances, then the meaning is, if we choose that patch, then the distance from the visual difference or distance from there to there and from there to there should be equal, and likewise also in the vertical in the value axis. Just let me finish this chapter. Another well-known perceptive color system in design and architecture is the natural color system, or NCS. So with NCS, you can describe all possible surface color and give them a unique NCS code. So the six pure colors, so white, black, yellow, red, blue, and green are the starting points to characterize the colors. So it's a kind of a similar type of system as the Menzel one. And typically application, at least in the Nordic countries, so the Swedish flag, definitely, the yellow color and the blue color in the Swedish flag are defined based on the NCS system. Middle Europe, there are a similar system. There is a RAL system, I remember. So for instance, Lufthansa, Deutsche Post, and so on, they use another type of system defining their color or colors. So some of these systems are also kind of private systems. So NCS, this is a commercial group. So if you want to know about the CLAB values, also the device independent values, then you need to buy the software, or you need to buy the patches, and you have to do your own measurements. So, yeah. Yeah, then to sum up the previous slides on describing color, whether the system is related to additive color mixing, to pigment mixing, or to color perception, we just learned that most of these color circles often have the properties of opponent channels, like red, green, yellow, blue, and black and white.
I think that I find my answer here. So it seems like it's a specific, just like Munsell, it's a specific, let's say, color cycle. So
which one are you talking about?
It's Eaton.
Eaton, yeah, okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that is the one.
Right. Yeah, Eaton, he's actually Swiss. I should know more about him. I think he has been very much into architecture and design. And now he has this yellow, red, and blue. And then the secondary color is the green, based on the primary color, yellow and blue. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's kind of different disciplines,
yeah.
Different choices. So, yeah, right. Okay, so let's see how many slides are remaining in that. Not this one, this one. Okay, yeah. Just one more minute, then we are done with that. So coming to the CIE terminology. So far we just basically talked about hue, we talked about lightness, we talked about saturation. But there are many more attributes, and the CIE has basically defined all of them. I don't want to dig into the definition, but if you just read the definition, it needs some time to digest. It's not that intuitive to understand what is the difference between colorfulness, saturation, and chroma, even though we know, based on the CIE, colorfulness and brightness is a visual perception, whereas lightness and chroma is a kind of more physical property. But I won't go into the details, so I just added that for the sake of completeness. So feel free to look up at the CIE publications, International Lighting and Vocabulary, to find these definitions. Perhaps you might use these definitions in the cross-media color reproduction course. Then you know where to dig into. Okay.
But which is the most like useful color scheme, like HSD, hue saturation brightness, as you demonstrated?
Also, that again, it's depending on the skills, it's depending on the application, but it's the most intuitive. So I'm not able, you know, to think in RGB values. Of course, I know 25500 is red, but then when it comes, you know, to kind of weird numbers, I really have to think. But then talking about U saturation and brightness, it is much more intuitive, especially if you have these type of user face I showed in Photoshop or any other type of image processing tools. So there is no standard answer to that question. Okay, let's have a 10 minutes break, so then we continue a 2:15.
Thank you. Jim Close one. And I think we will feel nice and good afterwards. So.
Sorry,
I said that we should feel like nice and good afterwards. So that's maybe a better motivation. But like just sitting here the afternoon, is that really, really putting me down?
This week it's okay because there is only this course. But I don't know for you, but like next week I will have like another course in the afternoon. It will be a long day. But what do you have? Like your other courses apart from this?
I currently have introduction to color science. Yeah, we are here. I have specialization on color something. Let me quickly check how it is called again. This course starts next week, so. Here we go. So I still have introduction to cyber and information security technology, but I think I'm going to drop this one. I have introduction to digital forensics, introduction to research on color and visual computing. That's where we're at. Specialization in color imaging, and the short course in Norwegian.
New courses, do you have?
Yeah, I will drop out of at least one, but I have to do four, so yeah, I have to do at least three courses, and but I need to do like 24 credit points, so that's why I will still do four courses.
I don't remember how much is a...
A course is like 7.5 code points.
So you have to
take
a fourth one. I mean, with what you have kind of...
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, the introduction was here, and the specialization
you said in the beginning that we should ask talk to you if we need books.
Yeah, if you want to borrow one of the books, or you want to make photocopies, or so, if you do not find the books in the library.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
So is there a specific chapter or book here?
Not right now. I just tried looking for some used ones. I couldn't find any, so I'm just looking for them. What would you say is the most important, or where to start?
So this Beast Tech key,
the one in copy by
yeah. I mean, that is and then what you find in all the books is definitely in there.
Okay, so if I get that one.
Diagrams, color diagrams, in black and white, like it
it's not the kind of
as a
technological tool,
it's
the kind of more
no,
it's a technical
yeah,
and also, you know, if you write articles, that's
definitely
a good book to decide. Then the other one, the one from Burns, that I showed five books, and I mentioned all the one is on my mind. That is a kind of more textbook, you know, for students to have some diagrams and, you know, some images and also some kind of not tutorial, but the kind of step by step approach, you know, how to obtain solid transforms.
Okay. Yeah, didn't I say 15:15?
Okay.
If you want to fill up the cup, feel free to do that.
Yeah,
so,
that's
I mean,
very
maybe I was not precise enough when I said 15:15, so. Okay. Okay. I see. You have already some projects? Okay, interesting.
Surviving
projects. Okay. Yeah. Good. Yes. Yeah, should we just continue and then, yes. So a scene so far specifying color can be a kind of challenging task. Even if we select a sample from a color ordering system such as the Menzel system or NCS, its appearance will probably change with changes in viewing and illumination conditions. So that is kind of very important to keep in mind. As dealing with perceptible systems, the viewing conditions are very, very important. And in general, I'm pretty sure you need to conduct experiments down in the lab, and then you need to write a report or a publication. Then the view to describe the viewing conditions are very, very important. So whether it is in dim light or it is in daylight, and what kind of color temperature, Kelvin, and so on. So these are very important parameters to add. So in general, writing a report or a publication, you can always keep in mind that it should be written in a way so that your mother or your father would be able to repeat the experiment. So that is a kind of the idea. And of course, it should not be kind of too detailed, or to have redundant information. But very often, and probably you have experienced that already many times, reading a paper and you need to find out the details. How has the experiment been conducted so that you can compare the parameters with your experiment? And then you don't find the information. It's really annoying. And you spend hell of a lot of time reading again, and it is not there. So therefore, it's these type of details, which perhaps are very obvious for you because you are spending hours down in the lab conducting the experiment, and then you forget to add that information, which is kind of can be important. Okay, so now the next kind of way of describing color is by doing color matching. And so there is a typical setup of a system. So we have a bi-party field. So that is one of the stimuli. And that is the other stimuli. So what you see here is basically what the viewer is looking at. So the viewer is looking into this box, and then he sees this bi-party field. And then the task for him to do is a color matching. So this part, the bottom part, or let's say I correspond to what it says here. So the top part can be considered as the test color. So that can be one color within the visible spectrum, also from 380 to 720 nanometers, generated by a certain light source or generated by a video generator. So that is a test color. And then the task of the observer is actually by using certain primary colors, red, green, and blue, to obtain a color match. So he has to conduct an additive color mixing experiment. And once he obtains a visual match, then basically you can take the reading, so how much red, how much green, and how much blue has been needed to obtain a match of the test color. So that is the basic idea, and that is also the basic of our colorimetry of the CIE system. And underlying trichromatic theory, so trichromatic, tri means three, chromatic, color, trichromatic. Theory is a set of rules known as the Grassmann law, which Grassmann has published in 1855. And Grassmann laws describes empirical results about how the perception of mixtures of color lights composed of different spectral distribution can be mathematically related to one and another in a color matching concept. So basically, he is describing the task of conducting a color matching experiment. And the laws are stated about color matches that are more or less true empirically. And there are mainly four type of rules added to the Grassmann law. So we talk about symmetry. That means if A matches B, then B matches A. So if a light source A matches light source B, then it is symmetry, or vice versa. And the second, the transitivity. So if A matches B and B matches C, then A must also match C. And the number three is then the proportionality. So if A matches B, then we can also add a constant K to A, and then that should match with the same constant also the light source B. And the last one, the additivity. If A matches B, and A and B matches B and D, then C matches also D. So these are the underlying rules to obtain Grassmann law, or the additivity law. So then next time I will explain a little bit more about the experiments that has been carried out in 1928 and 1931 from Wright and Stiles, which are still nowadays the foundation of the colorimetry we are using today. I can also add at that point, talking about the CLAP system and talking about the requirement having a three-dimensional system which is perceptible uniform, still after so many years and decades, we have not reached the goal yet. So there has been added a lot of adjustments on the existing system, and there has been used so much politics that we are still kind of on the move. But currently there is a PhD student, Luvin. He's actually building this color tutor in the basement using nowadays LED technology, using a monochromator to split the different test colors. And I hope during the autumn semester that the first observers can do the experiment on the new technology, with also new measurement technology. Also not just do the reading, how much red, green and blue, but using a telespectral radiometer to obtain exact measurements, which was not possible 100 years ago. And with that, we hope, of course, perhaps, and with a lot of politics and committees in the future, to a kind of, not reinvent, but coming with a kind of a more appropriate system. And that would be a kind of an excellent opportunity for you to conduct such an experiment, which perhaps can be quite time-consuming, sitting in the dark room for couple of half an hours or hours, as he estimated, and to conduct several test colors across the visible spectrum and do the experiment. So I hope that can be possible for you during autumn. Okay. So another chapter related to lighting. So the element light is a kind of very important parameter for detecting color or perceiving color or to discuss color appearance. So I have a couple of slides on lighting. And before we look into spectral power distributions and color rendering index and color temperature, there are also some terms to get familiar with. So let's consider first the basic parameters used in lighting. So we can distinguish between what is called luminous flux, luminous intensity, illuminance, and luminance. So the next four or five slides are then dedicated to these four different terms. So let's address the first one. We start with luminous flux, and the abbreviation is phi in the Greek alphabet, and the unit is LS for lumen, also light. So luminous flux describes the amount of light emitted by a light source in all directions, as indicated here. So we do have a bulb or a light source, and then luminous flux defines the light in all directions. Perhaps more precise, luminous flux is the ratio between light output and the power consumption. So in terms of how much energy or how much energy is used to run the bulb in terms of watts and the corresponding output in lumen. And as you know, buying different type of lamps, so this is still a halogen lamp, you have the energy used, 60 watts, and you obtain only 300 lumen for this 60 watt. Another kind of more environmentally friendly bulb, you get 700 lumen. I thought I had somewhere an example. So, for instance, if you have a 100 watt incandescent bulb producing 1600 lumen, then we can calculate as 1600 lumen divided by 100 watts. Then we end up with approximately 20, 15, 16 lumen per watt. An halogen bulb consumes only 70 watts, so then we obtain already 22 lumens. And with the nowadays technology of LED light consuming much, much less energy, but the effect in terms of lumen is much higher. So we talk about 80 lumen versus an incandescent bulb. And of course, that is also a major contribution to environment. So, we know an incandescent lamp, it produces perhaps only 10% light and 90% is heat. So with respect to the lighting technology, I think we are heading in the right direction. And basically, in this building, I think everything has been replaced with LED illumination. So, we can skip that. Then the luminous intensity, the unit is candela. Luminous intensity describes the amount of light emitting in a certain direction. So this is a useful measurement for directional light elements, such as typically reflectors. Then we talk about the luminous intensity for a certain direction. And then the third one, the illuminance, the abbreviation is E and the unit is LX or LUX. Illuminance indicates how much light or luminous flux hits a certain area of a certain size, also 1 square meter area, for instance. And it is measured typically with what is called a LUX meter. And there are specific standards that specify specific illuminants for a certain type of application. So I found in ISO standard for lighting of indoor places that for office work, 500 lux is a kind of recommended in the working area. And you have several type of lux indication for different applications. Okay, so that means the light illuminated at a certain area. Yeah, we also can skip that. We talked about scotopic vision, photopic vision. And then the last one, that is the luminance, with the abbreviation candela per square meter. Related to a display, what do we measure using candela per square meters? Probably you will conduct a couple of...
The screen, maybe?
Yeah, screen. Yeah, so what kind of parameter do we measure with candela per square meter? Yes?
Brightness,
yes. So brightness, we learned that is a kind of a perceptible attribute of the light. And the corresponding physical unit is candela per square meter. So if we measure a display, comes next week, we can do a calculation. So we obtain spectral values, or we can obtain spectral values from a display, and then we can calculate the x, y tristimulis values, and y, the y value in the CI system is corresponding to luminance. But let's take that next Tuesday. Okay, so if we wrap up the previous slide, starting with the light source, we have luminous flux in all direction. Then we have luminous intensity, candela. We have the illuminance, the lux at a certain area. And when it comes to the perception, the light entering the eye as we look into a display, then we talk about luminance or brightness, and the unit is candela per square meter. Taxonomy, we also talked about that. We can skip that. The importance to distinguish between lux and candela can be in this type of setup, which is a typical lab setup, where we have a certain display, and then we try to get a match of what we see on the display versus a physical print or a physical object. So then to calibrate the monitor, we can apply what is called ISO 12646, ISO standard display for color proofing, also the characteristics. I think we will do that in a couple of weeks down in the lab, then applying these ISO parameters for choosing the primaries, choosing the brightness level in terms of Condell per square meters, choosing the gamma, meaning the relationship between electronics and the perceived brightness between black and white. So that is the kind of tone reproduction curve, or it is called gamma. And the parameter number four is the white point. Yes, also the a kind of the color of the light source. So I would describe the color of this light source as a kind of neutral gray. But if I would lit a candle in the room here, then I would describe the light or the color of the candlelight as more warm, more yellowish. That is what I'm talking about. If we talk about white point, we can choose different white points on the display depending on the application. Yes, so that is the calibration of the monitor. And then we talk about candela per square meters in terms of the luminance. But when it comes to this type of setup, we need to find the corresponding lux so that we have a match between the display and the viewing cabinet. And there is a kind of rule of thumb, 127 times P, approximately 3.145, blah, blah, blah. We end up with approximately 395 lux. But that is, perhaps Phil gets back to that in a concrete setup. Applications, dimlit room, probably that's perhaps 60 lux in here. Office 500, I said, viewing booth for critical judgment. According to the ISO standard 3664, viewing condition, it is required to have 2000 lux. So if you have to conduct critical color work, then you should have 2000 lux. Normal daylight probably out there now is 15,000 lux. Display for critical color judgment, 160 candela, it's a kind of ISO standard if you want to calibrate your monitor according to a certain standard. So that you can communicate color with your business partner or with your colleague. So if we would use different type of luminance on different monitors, then it would be difficult to talk about the stimuli on the different monitors. So that is the idea of calibrating the monitor. And especially if you are in a environment where you work together, then there is no point inventing your own rules. Then you can just use an ISO standard, and ISO is worldwide, and it's everything is specified, and if everybody goes with these rules, then there should not be any misunderstanding. But you know, there is human factors, and it's still a lot of mismatch. Okay, let's go ahead with another chapter. Sometimes you can read about color and the triplet. So basically, what that means is, we want to specify the observer, we want to specify the light source, and we want to specify the object. So these are the three kind of elements needed to apply colorimetry and to describe the stimuli. So there are also a couple of terms, and an important term when it comes to light is spectral power distribution. So the spectral power distribution defines the amount of energy across the spectrum, basically. And that means we can specify or measure different spectral power distribution according to the light source we are using. Or we can apply a kind of theoretical spectral power distribution defined by the CIE, also by the International Illumination Commission, which has specified a number of a kind of theoretical imaginaire light sources. We talked about light. So how can we do that? We can use this light source, for instance. We can have a kind of a prism, for instance, which has the ability to differentiate or diffract different wavelengths, and then we are ending up with a rainbow. Or we can have a diffraction grating, which nowadays is a kind of a standard in each and every spectrophotometer. And then, so for instance, the spectral power distribution of a tungsten incandescent illuminant has this type of shape. So I'm talking about the energy level, and we know if we describe a tungsten lamp, I would describe it as a kind of a warm type of white light, and that corresponds with the energy. So it has much more energy in the long wave area and little energy in the short wavelength area. And at the same time also it has a very nice continuous spectrum compared to many other type of fluorescent type of lighting. So if you would measure daylight with a telespectroradiometer, then probably we will end up with these type of spectral power distribution, also an energy distribution, which looks completely different compared to the previous slide, where we have a kind of almost similar energy across the visible spectrum. And that is a typical fluorescent tube. Except from the color lab, there are no tubes anymore in that building, but we had no resources to replace the tubes which we installed about 20 years ago. And then if we measure the light of these tubes, then we get this type of a profile of a spectral power distribution. And any idea what these spikes kind of indicates? Can you think of some? It's white light, yeah, kind of, yeah. No, it's fluorescent, a tube. Do you know how a tube is functioning? What, gas? Yes, gas. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's a glass bulb. Then you have on the inside you have what is it called? An organic material. Hold on a second. Organic material, which which has the ability to transform non-visible electromagnetic power into visible light. Ah, what is the name of that?
Gain medium? Is that the term you're looking for?
No. Anyway, and in the tube there is gas. And basically, depending on the type of light tube, you have a certain gas. And this is the fingerprint, basically, of the gas used. So if, I think I have a mercury or a sodium lamp as well, that has a very poor spectral power distribution and basically just one line in the yellow. And that indicates that this is sodium. Yes. That was a project measuring the Jøvik daylight once. That's okay. Yeah, then you find several other examples in the textbooks. We talked already about different type of sky light versus incandescent lamp with sun. This is our fluorescent tube. Ah, different phases of daylight. That is what I meant. A, B, C, sunlight, northern light, C, and mixture of sunlight and skylight, the B. Okay. This is down from the lab. We do have this glass prism. Then I have this built this slit. So here I'm using a halogen bulb. This is also a fluorescent bulb. Then this is the halogen bulb, and we can see we obtain a kind of a continuous spectrum. That's the point. Continuous versus a line spectrum of the line. So do you remember the spectral power distribution of the of the incandescent lamp or a candle lamp? It has a very smooth transition compared to this fluorescent bulb, where we have a kind of a line spectrum. So that is just to distinguish between these two. And then, we still have street lighting in, old street lighting in Jøvik with low pressure sodium. So then measuring that street light, we end up just with a kind of a spike in the yellow part or like that. And then, of course, talking about color reproduction, using the color checker under this illumination and the camera, I'm ending up with this reproduction under this very poor low pressure sodium lamp. Compared to if I use the camera flash, then we can mimic kind of the daylight. So that is just to show how important this spectral power distribution is to trigger different nanometers through the visible spectrum to obtain kind of a color appearance. This is a typical white light generated from LEDs. And then I mentioned previously today with three primaries we can generate white light as shown here, or red, green, and blue, white light. Okay, that is the SPD. But nowadays, typically we have these type of SPD, a peak in the blue, and then we have a kind of a yellow phosphor. Ah, phosphor, that was the term I was looking for, which has the ability to transform electromagnetic energy into visible light. And then we can course save one element and still produce white light. Okay, a couple of slides to rendering index. Rendering index has not been a kind of a broad topic in the Color Lab either, but it's good to have a kind of a basic idea what is a color rendering index. So schematically, to the left, we see a light source that emits light with the same energy across the entire spectrum schematically. And then it is obvious that we can distinguish very nice all the colors. Compare to if we have a very poor SPD, where there is almost no energy in the middle part of the spectrum, so red and green is almost absent, and we end up with this color representation. So the idea with the color rendering index is then to give an idea about the quality of the light source. That is what the color index is all about. So it is a measure of the ability of the light source to reproduce the colors of various objects being lit by the source. So the idea is actually to have certain reference colors, and then in that case it's a kind of natural daylight, which is basically the best light you can have to render colors. And then you end up with a color rendering index RA of 100. So RA indicates the type of color rendering index used. Exactly as we talk about inch or centimeters. So if you look for a color rendering index, then you also need to look at what kind of abbreviation it is used, because that indicates this is the color rendering index which is 50 or 60 years old. That was a long time before LED has been invented, but